This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway. We're going to listen back to excerpts from two of the concerts we recorded with the great singer Susanna McCorkle. She took her life a couple of years ago at the age of 55, but she left a legacy of wonderful recordings. Many of her favorite songs are written for movies and shows, and she had a gift for making you hear old songs in new ways. Her first visit to Fresh Air was in 1987, when she performed with Ben Aronoff at the piano and Chip Jackson on bass. I want to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. And Susanna, before we talk about your music, would you sing a couple of songs for us?
I'd love to. The first one I want to do is my little tribute to Fred Astaire, a wonderful singer people think of as a dancer, but all those of us in music treasure his records, and songwriters loved writing for him because he was just a guy singing. He didn't impose himself on the song. He really gave a lot of attention to the lyrics and the music. So this is for Fred. If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits. Putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper, come let's go where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts, putting on the Ritz. One of my favorite lyricists is Yip Harburg, who tried to put his humanist politics into his songs and the shows that he wrote for. And I had the pleasure of meeting him when I was making a tribute album to him. I found out he lived right around the corner from me in Manhattan. I was terrified of meeting him. I'm always scared of meeting all the songwriters. And he was a bit forbidding because he was really worried that nobody young would understand his songs and what they were about and if they were supposed to be funny. But once he saw that I really knew a lot about his songs and extra lyrics and obscure songs, he opened right up. He was really wonderful and showed me a lot of unusual music. He did his own show toward the end of his life, and he always used to sing If I Only Had a Brain from The Wizard of Oz. I took another verse from The Wizard, from that same song that was sung by the Cowardly Lion and the Tin Woodsman and the Scarecrow, If I Only Had a Heart, and I was fascinated when he said that when he and Harold Arlen wrote the score for Over the Rainbow, they really tried not to talk down to children. They did adult songs. They didn't think of kiddie songs. And maybe that's why the songs have lasted so well, because this one seems really almost a song with an 80s sensibility. It seems to me that it could be a song about just being in touch with your feelings. Empty kettle, She should be on her mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kinda human if I only had a heart. I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, an awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy that shoots the arrows if I only had a heart. Picture me, a balcony above. Voice sings low, wherefore art thou, Romeo? I hear a beat. How sweet, just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart. If I only had a
That's beautiful. Susanna, you have just a magnificent voice. And I'd like to take a few
minutes. Do you, Terry.
Let's take out a few minutes to talk before you sing some more songs. And, you know, I've been listening to your records for years, but I know very little about you, so I really want to find out some more. When did you start singing popular song?
Well, I grew up always really loving songs. I used to listen to them on the radio, and my mother had a lot of Broadway show albums in the days when the music was just sensational, My Fair Lady and West Side Story and things, mid-50s and earlier South Pacific and Finian's Rainbow. So I always was fascinated by the stories in songs. I used to lie on the floor listening to them and figuring out who was singing them, why they were unhappy or what was, or happy. And I went through the 60s, like everybody, trashing all that and thinking it was stupid and establishment and boring. And it wasn't really until I went to Europe as a disenchanted youth in the mid-60s that I rediscovered, or really discovered for the first time, the richness of American popular culture, especially of the 30s and 40s, in movies, movie musicals like Fred and Ginger, Busby Berkeley, and dramatic movies like Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard. That was all new to me. And also old jazz records from the 30s, Duke Ellington and earlier Billie Holiday with the small group records of the 30s, and earlier Bessie Smith. And I became really fascinated by them and thought that there was a whole country that I hadn't known about growing up, and it must still be there, at least in vestiges. And I just really wanted to get with people who appreciated those things.
What happened in Europe to show you this kind of music that you had ignored during a period in America?
Well, it was the music of the intelligentsia there, really. It was the snob appeal at first, because I spent time with students and artists around my age, and they really knew so much about Charlie Parker, you know, jazz, and the records were readily available, even in the chain drugstores and supermarkets there. You could buy a Billie Holiday record for the equivalent of $2, and it was just more readily available. But I really only had to hear a Billie Holiday record once to know that she was something very special, and it was a tradition of singing that I felt deserved to be kept alive, very direct and honest, instead of either stagey and theatrical or folk music, which had a kind of innocence and guilelessness, but it wasn't really musically very sophisticated, or the Supremes, top 40 stuff. It just seemed a whole other way of singing and approaching music that I just loved. I was really ready to hear it, and it hit me like lightning.
After singing those kinds of songs in Europe, when you came back and when you were reunited with friends and family, were they really surprised at this new kind of material that you were doing?
Well, there wasn't really anybody to be reunited with. You know, I didn't have any friends from college, and I was living on the other side of the country from my parents. I just felt as if...
You changed your life then.
I did. I felt as if I didn't belong to anything. And then when I discovered jazz, I felt I belonged to jazz. It was like a tribe. And I was one of the strays who finally found my home tribe. And it always, at first I lived in England. I lived in London for a while. And I immediately felt that way. I had a shared sense of humor. And there were other things, different books that we liked, politics, movies, even foods. I felt, boy, these are my kind of people. And they were always here, but I just didn't know about them. And I still really feel that way, as if I'm a daughter of the tribe who has to pay my dues and go through certain things to be considered worthy of belonging to this tradition, you know. And I do love that feeling. I think Americans, at least WASPs like me, have a certain rootlessness. And that's, I found that popular music was my root, something good I could belong to and carry on.
We're listening back to a 1987 concert with the late singer Susanna McCorkle. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Let's get back to our 1987 concert with the late singer Susanna McCorkle. She was accompanied by pianist Ben Aronoff and bass player Chip Jackson. Susanna, we'll talk some more in a few minutes. I'd really love for you to do another song first.
Okay, well, I know you have a very arty program with lots of literary figures. So I'd like to do a song that would never have been written if it hadn't been for one of the great literary figures, George Bernard Shaw. I'm sure even he would have approved of the way Lerner and Lowe interpreted one of his plays. I've grown accustomed to his face. He almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune he whistles night and noon. His joys, his woes, his highs, his lows are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in, I was serenely independent and content before we met. Surely I could always be that way again. Yet I've grown accustomed to his looks, accustomed to his voice, accustomed to his face. I'm very glad he's just a man and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit I could always break. And yet I've grown accustomed to that trace of something in the air, accustomed to his
singer Susanna McCorkle. Your singing and your phrasing are really both magnificent. Do you have any formal training or anything?
I don't have any. I just always grew up singing in school choirs, which I think was great, to always just be confident about opening your mouth and singing. And we used to sing in the car a lot. We used to sing rounds. But the one time I tried, I was living in Rome, and I thought I should learn about breathing and scales. And so I had a friend who studied classical singing, and I went to the teacher who taught her, who was named Maestro Ricci, and he had pictures of Anna Moffo kissing him, Joan Sutherland kissing him. I knew he was the wrong one, but he insisted that he could teach me, and he told me wear a surgical corset and hold, you know, it's whack my jaw, macella morbida, you know, he says keep your jaw relaxed, and I was so intimidated I couldn't even say I didn't really want to sing opera. And finally, after a few lessons, he said, "I'm so sorry, really, you're well-educated young lady, you speak good Italian, but you will never be a singer. You have a tiny, tiny thread of a voice. I'm so sorry to be the one to tell you this." And I was really so relieved. You know, I said, well, really, I didn't want to sing opera. I wanted to sing, you know, Gershwin. I tried to think of composers he'd identify, and he said, "For this, you have enough of a voice already." You know, so that was really my only brush with vocal training. And I always do scales every day. I do 3 octaves of chromatic scales. And I try to keep in good shape, exercising, breathing. But as a jazz musician told me later in London, you know, if you just let go and make people feel song, nobody's going to worry about whether you read music or breathe right, you know. And many people have even said how good you didn't train, because I think there's so much emphasis on training that people tend to sound just alike. So, and my favorite singers just have a natural rough-edged sound. So even though sometimes I envy virtuosi who just have huge voices, I do notice sometimes you tune out of a voice like that. You just stop listening to the content in a way you would never do with Nat Cole or Billie Holiday or Ray Charles or somebody who's just more unique and kind of rough.
Well, your phrasing is also very personal, and it also seems to come from your heart.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I never consciously think of phrasing. I think of lyrics and the person I am singing the song and just try to feel the song and not be too intellectual about it.
So you had this short-lived period of taking lessons, which was a disaster. But you liked to sing. You sang in the chorus. When did you actually start singing or think that you would be a professional singer?
Well, I did some summer stock in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They had shows, Bye Bye Birdie and Lil Abner. And I sang in those, and I liked singing, but I didn't like doing the same thing the same way every night. So for a while, I just didn't sing at all. I thought it had just been a school kid thing. And I was in a choral group at the University of California, but I hated it. It was 99 girls singing hymns and Rodgers and Hammerstein medleys. I said, what is this? So I just stopped singing. I didn't even have record player or anything. It was really Billie Holiday. I have to say, Billie Holiday made me want to be a singer.
Did you ever fear when you started gravitating toward popular song and toward some of the classic composers that maybe you'd missed your time?
I've always felt really glad to live in the time I lived in, because I was in a very interesting political time at Berkeley and a very good time for women. I guess I would have been a starlet band singer if I'd been in the 40s, but I wouldn't get to be the woman that I am now, more independent, traveling and living alone in Europe. So I feel really good about it. I feel people said I was crazy to do that kind of music when I started in the early 70s, but that now people are ready to hear that. So I feel that I'm lucky that those records called out to me that way, and I wanted to heed the call.
The late Susanna McCorkle, recorded in 1987, with Ben Aronoff on piano, Chip Jackson bass. We'll hear an excerpt of her 1988 Christmas concert after a break. This is Fresh Air. During this holiday week, we're featuring songs from Hollywood and Broadway. In 1988, Susanna McCorkle returned to Fresh Air to perform a concert of Christmas songs. We're going to hear a couple of Christmas classics that were written for the movies. Accompanying Susanna was pianist Lee Musiker and bass player Dean Johnson.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us.
That's always such a sad song. It was actually an even sadder song I just read in one of those books of Hollywood anecdotes that you're always so ashamed of yourself for reading, but you keep on reading. When it was written by Blaine and Martin for Judy Garland, she said, "This is too sad. It's a sad moment. Our family's about to move to New York. We're afraid we won't be together again after this Christmas. But the words are so sad. This Christmas may be our last. And if I sing it sad and the song is sad, it'll be too sad. So just make it more neutral, and then I'll be sad, and then it won't be too much of one thing." I love that idea of Judy Garland sitting down with the songwriters and talking about it, the idea that you could be there when a great song is born, and as a singer who really thinks about what you're singing, have something to do with it and to say about it. And it is really enduring classic song that we just don't get tired of.
I think it's one of the best Christmas songs.
It is.
I'm glad you opened with it.
Christmas is sad. There is always a longing about Christmas, longing for what we never knew, even, except from the movies.
What's your next song?
This is by Irving Berlin. He was the best at writing holiday songs. And this one we have the verse, which is not usually heard. It makes the song a completely different song, not just about a Christmas with snow, but about going back home and having the kind of Christmases you used to have and remember best and love best. The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A. But it's December the 24th, and I'm longing to be up north. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. Where the treetops glisten and chill
of a white Christmas. With every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white.
The late Susanna McCorkle recorded on Fresh Air in 1988. Many of her recordings are still available.